Bevisst wir uns auf das Leben im Politoblog-Podcast, der ich gesehen hat, Tavarisch David Brooks.
Welcome, 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 comrades, to the second Politoblog podcast. I am your host, the Honorable David, well, David Brooks. Fairly honorable. Not a judge. So, this has certainly been a interesting week. It's, you know, something that we all should put into perspective and make sure we aren't rushing into anything here. As so many of you do know, General Flynn, the former director of the NSA, has resigned. And we're getting some different reports about it from the two largest mouthpieces of the White House, Sean Spicer and Kellyanne Conway.
I want to address the events of last night first and foremost. We've been reviewing and evaluating this issue with respect to General Flynn on a daily basis for a few weeks, trying to ascertain the truth. We got to a point not based on a legal issue, but based on a trust issue, where the level of trust between the President and General Flynn had eroded to the point where he felt he had to make a change. The President was very concerned that General Flynn had misled the Vice President and others. He was also very concerned in light of sensitive subjects dealt with by that position of national security advisors like China, North Korea, and the Middle East, that the President must have complete and unwavering trust for the person in that position. The evolving and eroding level of trust as a result of this situation and a series of other questionable instances is what led the President to ask for General Flynn's resignation. Immediately after the Department of Justice notified the White House counsel of the situation, the White House counsel briefed the President and a small group of his senior advisors. The White House counsel reviewed and determined that there is not an illegal issue, but rather a trust issue. During this process, it's important to note that the President did not have his Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, who he trusts immensely, approved by the Senate. When the President heard the information as presented by White House counsel, he instinctively thought that General Flynn did not do anything wrong, and the White House counsel's review corroborated that. It is not ordinary for an incoming national security advisor to speak with his counterparts about the issues of concern to them. In fact, he spoke with over 30 of his counterparts throughout the transition. As Charles Krauthammer said last night, it is, quote, perfectly reasonable for him to do so. The issue here was that the President got to the point where General Flynn's relationship misleading the Vice President and others, or the possibility that he had forgotten critical details of this important conversation, had created a critical mass and an unsustainable situation. That's why the President decided to ask for his resignation, and he got it.
Well, that makes sense. So, Spicer, obviously, towing, the White House line and going with, it's perfectly normal for a potential intelligence officer, which it is, to go and reach out to different countries, just have some talks about where we stand on things, how could we, bridge any divides and whatnot. None of that's bad. Not even Flynn talking about sanctions with Russia is bad. If this is the administration's viewpoint that Ukraine or the European Union or NATO are not, key allies that we should support and we want closer ties with Russia, well, yes, then you'd want to have a conversation about easing the sanctions. Did you all notice the point at the end here where Spicer said that is why Trump asked for his resignation? That is where things get a little muddier, and Kellyanne, who was also asked by President Trump to speak yesterday, essentially said the opposite, that Trumpist accepted his resignation, that Trump did not ask for the resignation. So why is this important? Well, reports are coming out that the White House knew that the Justice Department said that General Flynn could be potentially blackmailed by Russia weeks ago. That's right. Just about from the beginning, the Trump administration knew that Flynn was potentially compromised. The head of the NSA.
Wrong.
Compromised by one of our main adversaries. And they did nothing about it until the public reports came out from New York Times, Washington Post, and CNN. So anyway, here's Kellyanne Conway on the Today Show.
And we are back with Kellyanne Conway, the president's counselor. Kellyanne, thank you for joining us this morning. Of course, the big story today, General Michael Flynn. So the White House was told by the Justice Department last month that Flynn was vulnerable to Russian blackmail, yet he stayed in the job for, 17 days after the warning from the Justice Department. Why?
George, the General Flynn continued on the national security team and kept doing the presidential briefings, being on the leader calls. We are aware of the Justice Department opinion, but the fact is that not until yesterday, General Flynn continued in his job, and it became increasingly unsustainable for him.
I understand that, but that's my question. The question is why. The White House counsel was told by Sally Yates at the Justice Department that the General Flynn was vulnerable to Russian blackmail. Did the White House counsel tell President Trump that?
I don't know the answer to that, and President Trump has asked me to join you today to say that he accepted the resignation of General Flynn, and really the key here in that resignation is very simple. It's that the Vice President, Mike Pence, was misled by General Flynn, or General Flynn could not completely recall what his conversations had been
with the Russian ambassador. But Kellyanne, the White House knew that almost 3 weeks ago. They knew that after the Justice Department told the White House counsel, Don McGahn, almost 3 weeks ago that General Flynn had not told the truth about those phone calls and was vulnerable to Russian blackmail.
Well, these are what are in printed reports, but the fact is that I can't reveal what the White House knew or didn't know and who in the White House knew or didn't know. All I can tell you is that General Flynn, as a national security advisor to the president, continued in that role, and the president also wants me to refer everyone to the comments of Charles Krauthammer last night on a different network, wherein he makes the point that it's not this contact or this incident necessarily, it's the misleading of the vice president or the incomplete information. It's either it's being dishonest or forgetful.
Well,
I'd like to say that General Flynn had a 30-plus year honorable career in the military. He's one of the key intelligence officers of a generation. And we're sorry for this situation, but the president accepted his resignation, and he's moving on.
But I understand what you're saying there, Kellyanne, but this is exactly the point. 3 weeks ago, the Justice Department told the White House that General Flynn was misleading the vice president, was misleading the public about his contacts with the Russians. You had that information. The White House had that information, chose to keep General Flynn in his job, chose not to correct the record, chose not to tell the public what they knew about General Flynn's phone calls. How could that be?
But George, again, I'm not here to say who knew what when, because first of all, that would be divulging information that is highly sensitive, and secondly, I don't know all the details. I haven't spoken to everyone that you're talking about in that instance. It's a very fluid situation. It was obviously very fluid into the night. We were here very late last night. The upshot of it is that General Flynn did have a conversation with Vice President Pence, apart from what you're saying in printed reports. And General Flynn assured Vice President Pence something that turned out to not be true. And that's really the key here. I think that General Flynn, in the end, decided he was a lightning rod. He did not want to be a distraction, and he tendered his resignation last night because what he had provided the vice president either was a product of misleading information or forgetfulness, and neither one was sustainable long term.
Kellyanne, I got to get to the bottom of this here. You asked to come on this morning at the president's request. The president wants you to come out and speak for the White House this morning. Do you know if the president was told 3 weeks ago, when Sally Yates told the White House counsel that General Flynn had been compromised, do you know if the president was told that?
I do not know that, George.
Do you know if the vice president was told that?
I do not know that.
Do you know why the White House chose not to correct the record for those 3 weeks?
Well, again, you're presuming that all the information you have there is completely factual and who knew what when. And this is very fluid. I mean, the bottom line is that as time wore on, as everybody continued in their roles, it became increasingly apparent, particularly over the weekend, when General Flynn clarified his own earlier statement, George, a statement that he had provided to the vice president and that other members of the administration, frankly, went out and publicly repeated, which is that he had not discussed a certain topic in his conversations with the Russian ambassador. And so when General Flynn clarified those comments that it's possible and he could not recall, that accelerated matters in a way that was different.
And that's where we are today.
It is
a fact that the Justice Department did tell the White House counsel, Don McGahn, information almost 3 weeks ago. Final question. You said late yesterday afternoon that the president had full confidence in General Flynn. How could that be true?
Now, the president's very loyal. It just became unsustainable, and the president late last night accepted the resignation of General Flynn. Today he's moving on. It just became clear that we'll need to have acting National Security Advisor General Keith Kellogg in the role. He's been working very closely with the president for a number of months. And then, of course, we've been talking about a former Navy SEAL and Vice Admiral Harward and David Petraeus as well, General Petraeus, as Kellyanne, possible permanent replacements.
Kellyanne Conway, thanks very much.
Well, there you have it, folks. You know, there's the obvious discrepancy there, you know, but I think, you know, except for a little miscommunication there, where one person is saying that Trump asked for the resignation, one person saying that, no, it was in fact just handed to him and it was General Flynn that gave it. You know, I mean, what that ultimately goes to show is the dysfunction that we are seeing. Before I talk about this any further, I want to just clear up one thing. I think I previously mentioned that General Flynn was the director of the NSA. I just want to clarify, I meant to say the National Security Council. You know, what his job is, or was, excuse me, was to advise President Trump on matters related to national security. He was the National Security Advisor. Just want to clear that up. I misspoke and don't really want to go back and edit it. and I can also be honest about my mistakes. So back to the subject at hand. You know, so essentially when we get some of these big news stories coming out, you know, like the Russia thing that's just been, you know, going at us for so long, you know, there's a couple questions that I really like to ask. What exactly happened here? Like, you know, we got to operate within the strict confines of the truth. And then if there are more questions to ask, we ask them after that, right? And then why should I care? You know, obviously that there are issues in this world, plenty of them. And you know, we can't be caring about everything. And you know, empathy is one of the most important things in the world to me. But you're going to end up feeling miserable if you really take on every single issue in the world. You know, so you got to pick your battles here. You know, so the questions that remain here are, why hasn't the White House been more truthful about what's going on here? Supposedly, according to Washington Post and New York Times and CNN now, you have Paul Manafort and then Michael Flynn were communicating with Trump, or excuse me, with high Russian officials during Trump's campaign. And so that raises a whole lot of questions. Mainly, was there coordination at any level between the Trump campaign and Russian officials? If so, what did that coordination entail? This reminds me a lot of how the fall of Richard Nixon began, actually. The Pentagon Papers were classified documents that were provided to journalist of the New York Times, Daniel Ellsberg. And this was during the Vietnam War, and what these papers essentially did was show that the United States has been heavily involved in Vietnam for years and years, decades prior to the Vietnam War. You know, and ultimately what happened was a long, protracted battle. You had the Justice Department going through the court systems and forcing the New York Times to stop the presses so they couldn't print it. This is after they were told by, oh man, I don't remember off the top of my head, Howard Hunt maybe, I don't remember, but told by one of the president's top guys that, hey, you can't print this. And they all voted they're going to do it anyway. That night, told no by the courts. So they stopped. And then they decided to give some of the leaked information to the Washington Post. And then, boom, another injunction to stop it. And then they went to St. Louis, LA Times, Christian Science Monitor, and they Boston Globe as well. They started going, the journalists did, sending information to all these newspapers. So they created so many injunctions, so many lawsuits for the Justice Department to defend, it became too much. But then the courts ultimately ruled that they could release this information, and they did. And so what the Pentagon Papers did was after that, Ellsberg was going to be sued. Or he was charged, excuse me, not sued. And he was charged with treason, you know, releasing classified information, and that whole slew of stuff. And he was never actually even brought to trial. And the reasoning was because information about the plumbers came out. You know, and so what I'm getting at here is that this all eventually led to Watergate. And so, you know, the prosecutors would have no idea about what's going on until they get to, you know, from Ellsberg to the plumbers who are there to, well, contain leaks, stop leaks, cause leaks. You know, that's generally what they're there for. And so when it got to the point that, oh, hey, well, wow, these guys are actually asked by the president himself to do a number of heinous things, oh, wait, then you find out not only that, Nixon's recording all these conversations. yeah, I mean, so that was a pretty quick spiral. You know, we found out more and more and more investigative journalists did their thing. Information was slow to come out. Public was already against the war, but it was just kind of trickling out more and more and more and more how sinister this administration was. And so with Trump, you know, what we have here is multiple statements from him saying he's never met Putin. But then we have interviews of him with Putin from years ago. You know, there are, you know, reports that, you know, of course, that he's had close contact with him. You know, that when he was in Russia, he was urinated on by a prostitute. And you know what? Some of our intelligence community is backing up these claims, which is just amazing. And so the arguments that, you know, Russia has all this evidence on Trump, and that's going to be the ultimate goal is once you can prove that. So anyway, we have these statements by Trump, obviously for praising Putin. We have Pence, 2 years ago, saying Putin's one of the worst guys out there. A year ago, saying he's a better leader than Obama. Just absurd. But then we also have, you know, Trump wanting to shrink the EU, talking about getting rid of NATO, talking about defunding the UN. These are all mechanisms in place that are stopping a man like Putin from invading Poland, Hungary, Romania, you know, all the Baltic states. I mean, the list goes on and on here. And, you know, there are a lot of people that want that to happen. If we can make Russia great again, you know, that's a foe. And, you know, that might, you know, be a Cold War Part Two for the U.S. That would be a real Cold War Part Two. But if you follow the news at all, Russia's economy is, I mean, it's smaller than California's. You know, I mean, they're not anywhere close to being an economic threat. They're a military superpower. Their economy I want to say isn't even as powerful as Italy's. And, you know, of course, Italy is a much smaller state dealing with much fewer resources than a country like Russia. So that just kind of, you know, that's a sidetrack. So other things on Trump with Russia that are just raising these questions, right? You can't answer the question before you even know a question to ask. So you got to dig in a little bit. You have somebody like Paul Manafort, who is once the chair of Trump's campaign, mind you, who's been accused of being in contact with Russian officials. Now, he was an advisor to Yanukovych, who was the Ukrainian leader that during the time period a few years back when Ukraine was looking at joining the European Union, you know, and there was talks of that, and that's what the people there wanted. Yanukovych was the leader that then was for it and then against it, saying it's not going to happen. And this was after threats from Putin. And then they took a very pro-Kremlin stance after that. And then what happened, of course, were protests. And then you had Ukrainian special forces firing live ammunition at people. And that eventually has led to the civil war that we see today. Of course, the annexation of Crimea was a major escalation in all that. So you have this situation where Paul Manafort was an advisor to a pro-Kremlin Russian president. And now he's accused of coordinating from the Trump campaign with Russian officials. That is opening up a can of worms. And what we're going to see over the next few weeks is a lot of information coming. I don't imagine that this story is going to be dying down anytime soon. You know, at this point, you just got a little sliver of the truth here. If we all remember back to 2016, if we want to remember back, right? But if we do, the timing of those WikiLeaks releases was one of the damnedest things in the campaign. You know, and at first, you know, during the Bernie campaign, when they, you know, are leaking the DNC stuff and all that stuff's coming out, right? A lot of that's making sense. And you know, for me, I've always been so on WikiLeaks. Because some of this information is just gets people in a whirlwind or thinking there's something to it when there's not, like the Pizzagate BS. Oh, other of it is just great information. Super interesting to know about. It's important to know and, you know, what's going on here behind the scenes to hold our leaders accountable. But I don't get it. Either Assange just really, really hated Clinton, or he is some weird alt-right fascist dude. Neither of which would really surprise me. But there's a couple things that, you know, jump out at me. Every time one of these Trump scandals would come out, the public was reminded that, hey, something's not right about Hillary. We don't exactly know all the details about what's not right, but we know that she is too invested into playing it as a game, that she really skirts that line between legal and illegal, moral and immoral, that she really wanted to be president. You know, and so we're getting all these leaks just to remind us, boom, 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 tape about Trump, it's devastating, how can Trump recover? Boom, emails. Boom, FBI reopening investigation. Boom. I mean, it's just like one after another, right? And it's just lumping onto the American people. And so it's getting them into this thought like, well, wait. I mean, CNN was outrageously pro-Clinton during the primaries. And then, of course, during the campaign. But, I mean, Bernie wasn't getting any news. He was getting about 30 seconds, if that, to Hillary's, you know, 10 minutes or so, and like Bernie would even win, and they would be like, oh, this doesn't derail Hillary's chances one little bit, you know. And it's like, you know, all the editorializing of news. Of course, you have Donna Brazile just giving Hillary the questions beforehand in debates. But anyway, all this editorializing of news that just happens off the cuff from a reputable news organization like CNN that is supposed to be there to present the facts, right? And then let you decide. Yeah, they're going to have their opinionated editorial segments. But when there's news, there's news. And there used to be a clear line with that. But anyway, you know, I mean, it was very clear, you know, with all that was going on, that CNN was very pro-Clinton here. And so you have all these WikiLeaks coming out, all this information coming out. You know, Bernie seems to be super popular, not getting on TV. Trump's an embarrassment, saying all this crude stuff that would just destroy anybody else's campaign. And it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger because he's hitting home on a number of these issues that are important to a number of Americans. And so the question really comes with, when you have somebody like Assange, who has gone on record saying he has information on Trump, but he's not releasing it because it's no worse than anything that Trump says every day, which may be true. But he also released the strangest, you know nothing emails from Hillary, where it's literally like, oh, hey, Hillary, hope your day is going well. Or it'd be, you know, from, you know, Debbie Wasserman Schultz to, like, John Podesta. And it'd be like, yo, 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 John, you know, what's happening? You catch the friends we were on this weekend? You know, and it's like, and that stuff that makes it. But yet, Assange's list, laughing off, oh, Trump, yeah, don't even worry. But the information I got on him is nothing. Yeah, don't worry about it. You know, and that to me is just like a red flag. I mean, we all know that him and Clinton did not get along. You know, Assange, you know, must have extra information on them or believe certain facets of things or. You know, I never saw an actual interview with Hillary saying this, but it's been widely reported, and I've heard it from many people, that Hillary said flat out that she wants to kill Assange. So, yeah, I mean, you know, maybe they just got their beef, and that's that, and that's why he did it. But it's very suspicious, especially when you have high-up Russian, I forgot, the deputy ambassador, I believe. But you have these Russian officials coming out, and they're saying, like, oh, yeah, it was us that fed information to WikiLeaks. They don't even know it was us. And then you have Assange coming out and saying, like, oh, no. We didn't get the information from the Russian government. But how do they even know? So there's all these different questions that a lot of us are asking in our day-to-day lives. It's hard to even keep up with everything that's going on. It's like every day, it's a new outrageous thing that would derail any other presidency or candidate or anybody. And we've been through this for over a year now. And definitely no signs of getting any better. So I'd love to hear your thoughts. You know, what do you make of all this? What do you make of, you know, having Sean Spicer and Kellyanne Conway going out there and not being able to answer some very basic questions about who knew what when, what happened when, how does this person feel about this? And you have President Trump sending them out there to answer these questions. So I would like to hear from you, and I'd like to hear, what questions do you have about what's going on right now? You know, the only thing that I would say is that generally in life, when you're accused of something that is not true, you provide evidence. You, you know, will show your support for the United States over Russia, right? You'll back are old alliances. You won't hire people with such close ties to pro-Kremlin dictators. You know, and so all of this just begs the question, every time that this stuff happens, Trump is lashing out fake news. You know, MSNBC and CNN, unwatchable. Go watch Fox and Friends or whatever it is. And that's how he's resorting to this. You know, he just brought up Hillary's losing campaign again in a tweet. You know, that was one of his responses to this Flynn stuff, is that, you know, oh, well, you can't believe it. This is just fake stuff brought up by Hillary's campaign. And then you have him just accusing, you know, fake news and all that. And what you have here is somebody that just can't come out and say, there's no truth to this, I do not like Putin, or, you know, my relationship with Putin is only on a leader-to-leader level. We never communicated during the campaign, undeniably. And then not only that, but then be willing to open up, you know, to launch an investigation. And that's just it. It's like, you know, what do we have, 13 different investigations into Benghazi to try to find stuff on Hillary or Obama and wrongdoing? I don't understand why we can't, you know, if we're spending billions on a wall, and if we're talking about drug testing for people on welfare again, and if we're talking about just repealing Obamacare with no replacement, all these things that could potentially cost the American person individually thousands of dollars. You know, I mean, it's like, if we're talking about all this crap, right? Why can't we, you know, spend a few hundred thousand dollars on an investigation into these connections? You know, and some senators, you know, you have John McCain, Lindsey Graham, both Republicans, and they're coming out and they're pretty much saying, like, listen, we support an investigation. We want to do this. The Democrats want to do it. So then, right then and there, you're at your 50-50 mark if any voting needed to take place. There are plenty of other Republicans out there that are concerned about this. And, you know, just being concerned doesn't, I don't understand why Trump would be so against this if there is nothing to it. He wouldn't be fighting tooth and nail over all this crap unless there is truth to it. Because if he had nothing to hide, he would let us see, you know? And it's like, and that's been a repeated thing with his, you know, not releasing tax returns, not doing all this. It's like, oh, if he had nothing to hide, he would let us see, and he wouldn't care about that stuff. So anyway, love to hear from you. Want to know, what questions do you have? What would you say, if you could ask a question to Sean Spicer or Kellyanne Conway? Yeah, who knows what type of spin they had put on it. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Politiblog podcast. I'm not sure how I always get off on these little weird synth tangents, but sometimes you just got to go with it. It's what makes me me, right? You know, so I kind of, you know, got going on a little roll there. You know, the Russian WikiLeaks stuff is so fascinating. I mean, you know, it's either I mean, you know, Trump is right, and this is just some bitter campaign revenge from the Hillary campaign. Like, oh boy, that's a pretty good, well done play. That certainly seems unlikely to me, though. So one of the other things that has been kind of talked about today and covered on C-SPAN, the GOP conservatives and Freedom Caucus as well, led by Rand Paul, have come out with, I don't know if you really even, I guess a plan. Obviously not a full draft of legislation, but a general idea of what they're going for here. You know, and so what they repeatedly said is that this is going to only serve to, like, start the debate, right? Maybe there are things we want to add to the bill. Maybe there are things that we should take out. I love that approach, and I think that that's a good approach. I disagree with a lot of Rand Paul's ideas. I was very surprised that he thought Betsy DeVos would be a good education secretary, but then again, he wants to get rid of the Department of Education. So I guess maybe those two goals fall in line. A couple of the things that they talked about here today, just in a little press conference, whether or not to keep the Medicaid expansion, whether or not to do keep the regulations on pre-existing conditions. They all agree the mandate's a bad idea, forcing everybody to have health insurance. If you're self-employed and maybe you're just in unbelievably terrific shape, you'll just have to pay the penalty. Or pay for the health insurance, which is just, you know, costs, as we all know, tend to be going up, 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 and up. In Minnesota, where I was born and raised, I know it's been hit very hard with that. The costs for Obamacare premiums have really skyrocketed. So there are a lot of issues to fix. There's a lot of good about Obamacare. A lot of things that I disagreed with from the beginning, but I bought into the idea that it's not a perfect bill, but it's there and can be improved on. That's the approach I would like to see. I don't feel that's unlikely because repeal and replace has been a Republican slogan for years now. So what Rand Paul wants is there to be a deadline for Obamacare to be repealed by February 28th, 2017. That's right, folks, within the next 2 weeks, with no plan yet. And then he wants there to be a deadline to have a plan until the end of March. So giving them a month and a half to try to, completely overhaul our healthcare system. Impressive. That'd be amazing if they could figure that out. So the scary thing is that Rand Paul's ideas, but what I at least heard, and maybe this is going to change, who knows. But at this point, there's a belief that pre-existing conditions should be governed by the free market. So if you're born with some disability, and or maybe you end up getting sick later down the line, and it's because you were born with this disability, or there's something that came up along the way where you needed that medical coverage, just deny you. And that's the scary part, is that there's no place in the free market to cover that. I mean, it is saying that, hey, if you're poor, and hey, if you, were born with the illness, or if, if you get hurt and then you get dropped by insurance and then another insurance company picks you up, and then it's like, oh, well, I need, to have arthroscopic surgery to see what's going on my previous surgery. Oh, that's not covered, bro. And that stuff was happening all the time. So that the plan that they just proposed today, and again up for debate, so that's, I'm just proposing some questions here. So they want to have a 2-year window, right? So you have your pre-existing condition, there's that 2-year regulatory window where they have to approve you, right? And so it doesn't say what they can charge you, they just have to approve you. Private health insurance companies, mind you. And so if, like, let's say you're working for a company, right? And you're falling to this 2-year window, which, you know, many people get their health insurance from companies. That's how it works in the United States for the most part. So if you have your health insurance through your employer, you have a pre-existing condition, and they're like, oh, yeah, we'll cover that. You have a 2-year window. Well, let's say after that 2 years, at some point in your life, you're like, you know what, I'm kind of sick of this job, so I'm going to go somewhere else. Or maybe they don't like you anymore, so you get fired. You would not be able to then get health coverage for that pre-existing condition under these plans. I mean, you might be able to find it for who knows how much, but you wouldn't have the rights in place that you do right now under the Affordable Care Act. And so, I like some ideas of, you know, what they're talking about a little bit, but 99% of them, man, they're struggling to try to find alternative ways to provide affordable health care, and they don't have alternatives. You know, I found the 2-year window a little interesting, seeing as the next round of elections will be 2018. Well, the next national round, right, will be 2018. So we're expected to, you know, maybe see some change there. And, you know, I think that there's just an overall belief from Republicans that there are certain things in your life that you're responsible for, right? I mean, I think, you know, everybody agrees with that. I mean, I don't want the government involved in my bedroom or in, you know, other weird ways or in every little facet of my life. But I'd like them to continue, you know, fire, roads, police, military protection, you know, providing, you know, legislative frameworks, judicial system for people there, their grievances, you know, and doing some things like that are amazing. Overall, regulation, I think we have too much of it, but, you know, in the right areas is extremely beneficial. I mean, no doubt about that. So the question is, if we sit back for a moment, the question here is, is universal health care right for America? And where do we draw the line on the social safety net? And that's a tough question to answer. It really is. I'm for single payer health care. I think the bit, which, by the way, I'll just explain what that is a little bit. What it does is it just allows a group of people, such as the American taxpayer, to use their collective bargaining and negotiate with pharmaceutical companies to get the best prices on drugs. Pharmaceutical companies do it with almost every other country in the world. In the United States, we're not so lucky. And unfortunately, you know, some government programs like Medicaid can do that. But, you know, we're not a single payer system yet. And right then and there, by doing that, you're lowering costs. I mean, these pharmaceutical companies are raking in the billions, you know, bonuses in the millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions. Healthcare companies, too, with health insurance. And so, obviously, they're doing pretty damn well. And so there definitely needs to be that reform here. Strike a balance between freeloaders living off the system, corporations gouging the customer, you know, poor health care, good health care, government oversight, or just free for all. There's that balance to be made. And so the question is, where does that lie? Some of the tricky things with universal health care are, you know, the argument would go like this, right? If you have society invested in everybody's health, then you have a prerogative to ensure you have healthy citizens. And so some of you might be like, oh, well, what's the problem with that, David? And maybe there isn't one. I believe there is. So France recently banned soda refills. Yep. You walk into McDonald's, you order, you know, your Coca-Cola. Let's say you wanted two. No. You can't do that. You know, they're trying to curb obesity. As we all know, France is a fairly socialist state, more so than the United States is, although we're still fairly socialist as well, in a lot of regards, more so than China, oddly enough. But anyway, what you have here is France now has the prerogative where they need to go out and ensure the health of their citizens. So the United States, that would include, or could potentially include, you know, saying some restaurants are okay and some aren't. You can serve this, but you can't. You can have 20 hamburgers a year, no more. Obviously, that's a bit of a stretch, right? But I mean, the argument's there. Once the government does have the ability to say, hey, you know, your health is an investment for us, then we can have a slippery slope. So ideally, for me, what we would see is a system where, first off, I'd like the states to be more in control of it. You know, simply put, there are some states that have a system set up where universal health care would make sense. You know, and it would help out quite a bit. And then there are some states where, I mean, it's going to help, but maybe that's not the best approach. Maybe an expansion of Medicaid. You know, Medicaid for people making $40,000 or less a year. You know, to have that extra health benefit would be amazing. The United States government as itself could operate as an insurance entity for catastrophic coverage. You know, so, you know, there could be a plan out there, which there already are a number of catastrophic plans available, of course, under Obamacare for very cheap. You know, but there's no reason why for $500 a month you can't offer this catastrophic care. And so one of the things Republicans have decided to propose instead of, you know, just instead of forcing people to get health insurance, and if you don't, we are going to take your money. They're doing the reverse, right? They want to reward people that have health insurance. And so, you know, it would be, I may have missed the numbers, but it would be somewhere along the lines of a $1,000 to $2,000 tax deduction, right? You know, which is, you know, arguably a better approach, you know, to reward people for going through with this. Instead of just saying, no, you know, screw you, even if you're poor, you didn't get health insurance, just screw you. And that's not the approach that I think was the goal of the Affordable Care Act. I can guarantee you, Obama, who wanted single-payer universal health care, you know, did not exactly want some of this to go the way that it has, but sometimes you gotta you know, make some lemonade when you get handed the lemons. So there's so many different concepts here at play. Republicans want to roll back Medicaid, but then you have, oh boy, 20-some GOP-controlled states where the Medicaid expansion went through. And so there's a lot of GOP senators and congressmen that are concerned about this. But if you keep Obamacare and just try to change some of the things, well, then you're going to have people like Rand Paul in the Freedom Caucus drawing the line in the sand and saying, no way. No, we're not going to stand for it. In fact, Rand Paul even said today that if the conservatives think that they can get away with not repealing Obamacare, they're going to be sorry come election day. And that's not word for word, but that's the gist of what he said. So the warning is out there that, hey, you're not all really conservative, and we know that, obviously, because you're looking to waste all this money on building a stupid friggin' wall, and you want to start trade wars with Japan and China and Mexico. But anyway, you have these all this opposition going on, and then Trump isn't even saying a damn word about healthcare. He's focused on all this other stuff and things like Nordstrom's dropping Ivanka's line of really, you know, poor clothing that nobody was buying. You know, it's like, you think you can bully your way into forcing people to buy her clothes? Oh, boy. So, I'd love to again hear from you. What do you like or dislike about Obamacare? Should we keep it as is? What do we need to change? Are there alternatives that we haven't really thought about? Again, some of my libertarian friends just keep saying that charity can fill the gap with all this. So I'm impressed, and so I would challenge you, if you're libertarian, why don't we see how many charities would be out there that we could possibly come up with a good, you know, $250 to $500 billion a year that'd be willing to just give that money away. Because honestly, if they're out there, if those charities are out there, we might be onto something. But I will remain skeptical. Be right back. Welcome back. I'm not really even sure what that was. Just some bells. There you have it. The bells. So on one last note before we depart for the week. There's an interesting little tidbit coming out from Mexico. There is a congressman who is proposing this bill that would suspend, just flat out stop, trade, all imports in the United States of corn. And corn is actually one of the really big exports and money makers of the United States. It's amazing how much our agriculture brings in. We are a nation that is powered primarily on farmers. And I think that that is something that really gets lost in a lot of these arguments here on, oh, what to do about this, what to do about that. And that, you know, they wouldn't have done this if it was just over building a wall. But it's all the stuff that's going on here. The ICE raids, you know, picking up, you know, mothers that have, you know, their children are in high school and are born here, and they've been in the country for 20 plus years, and the locals in that community are happy to have the people there, and then you have federal agents coming into these neighborhoods and just taking people. So you have this stuff going on. You have Trump wanting to get rid of NAFTA or change it, wanting to enact up to a 20% tariff. Tariffs here, tariffs there, everybody gets a tariff. So, in 2015, which is the most recent year we have data available for, apparently, don't ask me how, but American farmers sent $2.4 billion worth of corn to Mexico. This corn is being grown all over the country, mostly in Minnesota, Nebraska, Iowa, Illinois, Kansas. You have the heart of the Midwest. And these are what our country is founded on, and these are the types of people that are the backbone of the country, and we couldn't do anything without them. And a lot of them voted Trump, and a lot of them are going to find corn values dropping considerably. And so, you know, how corn goes is, you know, a lot of it is feed corn, right? You know, it's not all the delicious sweet corn that needs to be shipped out. Well, I mean, you know, it can sit around for quite a long time. But, you know, realistically, it should be shipped out within a couple months. Compared to feed corn, which can sit around for a couple years to try to weigh, you know, when the best time is to sell, right? That's what a lot of these co-ops do, is farmers will come in, they store their grains there, or they sell them to the co-op, they get their money. Co-op can keep it, sell it, judging by the day, judging by the market. Undoubtedly, if this bill gets passed, the value for corn is going to plummet. And that's going to be a big deal. And so what we're seeing here is one of the consequences to Trump's bullying approach. The thing is when you have a business, and if you want to go in there all bullheaded, right, and you want to try to get Mexico to let you build a hotel for no taxes or whatever you want, or you want some, you know, write-offs or benefits or building there, whatever it is, you can go in there and you can be bullheaded, because you're going to create jobs, you're going to be putting in investment, you're going to be doing all these things that a businessman does. And if they say no, you can be like, fine, maybe I'll go to this municipality, or maybe I'll go, you know, to Dominican Republic or Honduras or Ecuador or any of the other of the many countries that would accept a hotel and be a similar destination. When you're president, it doesn't quite work that way. There's only so many countries in the world that want to buy our corn. And I mean, it's a lot of them, don't get me wrong. But you gotta have a marketplace, right? And so you're taking a country like Mexico, which, gosh, I'm gonna struggle to remember off the top of my head, but over 100 million people. Boy, I'll probably be correcting this next week, but yeah, I wanna say it's over 150, 200 million people. Very populous, right? And you're just willing to throw away $2.5 billion in trade over these things. So how are we going to make that up? And it's not about making it up to the average American taxpayer. It's about making it up to the farmers. How are we going to do that? And I would like Trump to respond to that. That'd be an interesting thing. I would hope he could articulate a response. Because I can tell you, Mr. and Mrs. Farmer, it is not Mexicans taking your jobs. Democrats don't want to take your guns. Where I'm from, the Democrats have been the number one supporter of farms. Democratic Farm Labor Party is what we're called in Minnesota, DFL. And I can tell you that if your state Democrats have not been supporting the farmer, they're idiots. They need to step up and realize that without you, what we got crumbles. And it's not these big corporate farms that I'm talking about here that have, you know, a billion turkeys stuffed into, you know, a few city blocks. I'm talking about the farmer, you know, with a few hundred, few thousand acres that is out there working their ass, risking it every year. It's a shame that you're going to be caught in the middle of a silly trade war over some dumb wall and over some dumb tariffs because we can't find a more common sense approach. Thank you very much for listening, everybody. I appreciate it. This is David Brooks from Politiblog, signing off, wishing you a happy and stress-free next week. I guess I won't see you again. Until I talk to you again through this microphone. Take care.
Politicians are all talk, no action.
We have very stupid people in our country negotiating for us.